Welcome to the Mead House. This is Jeff.
Hey, this is Chris. Glad to be back. Having a great week. How about you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. We got back from vacation. We're doing a good, you know how a vacation goes. You get back to the house. There's so many things you forgot to do before you left, and now it's, I got to go to work tomorrow.
It's like you need a vacation from your vacation. Yep, I know how it is.
But hey, that's neither here nor there. I'm with my buddy. I'm drinking some mead. So
yeah,
let's tip a little back.
So what are we talking about with mead today?
Today, as we teased last week, we need to talk about our 12%.
Yes, we're going to do that. It's been long enough.
Right. We've been teasing this one for quite a while. This is your basic starter mead, shall we say. And this is the next step up from our 8%er.
Going to a mere 12%. Mirror being relative, because that's 8 mirror. you're talking some serious fortification there.
Right. But this is a lot more alcohol quantity by 50%, obviously. There are more techniques we need to talk about.
Yes.
There are more little things to be aware of. There are just so many different things that with the 8%, we can kind of let slide because it's just 8%. It's not a big deal. Blah, blah, blah.
But, you know, but I've learned that, because I started off horribly high at almost 18.
Mm-hmm.
There is so much more to worry about.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just so much work involved. I'm glad I had you help me hold my hand through it, because it would not have turned out well. But I'm finding out as I'm doing, 10 to 12s now, up to 14s mostly.
Yeah.
Much easier to manage. Much easier to manage.
And that 10 to 14, I think, is in the sweet spot for me, for a mead maker, as far as like flavor balance, flavor preference goes. If you go above that into like the, you know, above 14%, yeah, you get a stronger mead. And if you like sweet meads, it's easier to do that. But you're not only fighting the three legs of that table, you're also dealing with just the burn of the alcohol. Mm-hmm. And that can, like, that can kick the ass of lighter flavors that I like playing with.
Oh, yeah.
It's just not. Anyway.
But here we're talking about 12%.
Yeah.
A nice middle ground. And our mead today is, it's a prickly pear.
Yeah. This is a carbonated prickly pear from Valkyrie's Horn. Again, we don't have any information as the entrant. It's just kind of one of the leftovers. But
pretty, pretty red color.
Yeah. Very light red. Kind of pretty good amount of carbonation coming off of this. Still bubbling off. The head was substantial when it poured. And then, you know, like we talked about before, there's no real proteins to, like, hold on to that head with mead, so it's gone. But
yeah,
it's just fine.
Very light smell.
Mm-hmm. It's got a round, fruity note. I don't know if I would pick it out as prickly pear, but
I probably wouldn't, but it's
prickly pear is kind of a weird.
Since I don't have any deserts around me, I don't have extreme access to prickly pear smell.
Yeah. I know what prickly pear tastes like. I don't know if in the back of my mind I can, like, recall prickly pear smells like blank, you know? It's a round, fruity smell, though. There's fruit. It's more probably a honey smell than a fruit smell, but
yeah, I can smell a sweet.
Yeah.
But I like that fruit smell.
It's sweet and fruity in an almost generic kind of way, I guess. That's all I'm getting.
And on first taste, yeah, the carbonation is actually kind of important on this one.
Mm-hmm.
Without it, I think it'd be a little bit heavy.
Yes.
But with the carbonation, it makes a very pleasant mead. I mean, I could stand for a touch sweeter on this one.
Surprisingly, I think I could too. There is a note in prickly pear that I think it goes into the aftertaste that is not vegetal to me, but it's kind of vegetal. It's
and I think I know the taste you're referring to. I think I taste it here.
Yeah, it's
on the back of the tongue.
Right. It's kind of not exactly bitter, but it's not exactly like a sweet fruit either, and it lingers, unfortunately.
Yeah, it does. Like that little almost bitter taste kind of lingers longer than anything else in my mouth.
Mm-hmm. Which is not to say this is a bad mead. That is, unfortunately, I've had, we were talking about this when we were getting set up. I've had some kind of a prickly pear, like schnapps or like a little spirit or something from Malta, I think, is where they made
it. Yeah, yes, we mentioned.
And it had the same kind of thing going on. There was that aftertaste is just kind of,
it just may be indicative of prickly pear then.
Right, yeah. I think that's just part of the whole overall experience of it. But
I'm not saying it's the bad mead in any way. I'm saying the aftertaste is the most, not to be mean, but it's the worst part of it.
Yeah. And it's almost like, The aftertaste is almost coming across as like too tannic. You know, it's got
Yeah.
that kind of drying sensation.
It's close to tannic. Doesn't have
Right.
that across the top of the mouth.
It's not exactly the same, but it is. It has that kind of like, even when you like do the, you know, you drag your tongue across your teeth or your palate, and it kind of clings a little bit because of the tannin. I'm getting a little bit of that. I mean, there is tannin in the fruit, but
Yeah.
I don't think it's just a, you know, this fruit has a lot of tannin, so I don't like it. It's just a
I think it's
character of the prickly pear has kind of that flavor note that is a little could be better, but
I think it could, I think you could be, I think this could be worked around though. This feels like something you could fix overall. So, not mad.
No, and again, I think you're right on the money. This is the carbonation lightens this up a
Yeah,
considerable
considerably.
amount, because it would be heavier body otherwise. This makes it, and I think for a light, fruity flavor like this, that kind of works
Yeah.
for it. You know,
I think carbonate this was a good call. Who made this good call?
for sure, for sure. And yeah, no, that lightened up the body. The other option for you was to make a lighter mead, and you know, that's not going to give you the same flavor component that you're looking for here. So I think that was a good choice.
Well done.
Yeah. Hey, you know who else we need to thank, though?
Our listeners.
Our listeners.
Yeah.
You guys are tuning in week after week. We appreciate that so much. And again, it's not like we're taking over Joe Rogan's spot on the podcast listings or anything, but just seeing those numbers climbing means that you guys are doing your part to, you know, share this with your friends and listen and tune in week after week and, you
We
know,
really appreciate it. We
talk
really do.
about it. This is an organic kind of growth that I could not ask for. I'm not could not be any happier to be a part of. So thank you guys, sincerely.
And also, we need to talk about Bacchus and Barleycorn,
As
our
usual,
sponsors.
yes.
Great place to go. We talk about Jake. We talk about his buddies all there. They're all there. Great guys. Always with a welcome in. What can I do for you? Ready to help you. Ready to talk about anything you need to talk about. And if you have questions, I'm getting this certain thing happening this certain way. What can I do? I've actually seen a couple come in with a cherry mead they were working on, and I can see the cherries floating in this mead.
Really?
Whole cherries.
Interesting.
Not very many, but there were some. And they said, "This is our problem child, Funk, with his 3 gallon, a half full 3 gallon carboy." And she goes, "We need help." And he goes, and they put four other bottles. And he goes, "We'll put these to this aside now." And they tried the other four, which was a maple mead, a creamsicle, a blueberry cinnamon.
Okay.
And I don't remember the other one off the top of my head, but it was nice. I mean, they're new. They're like a year into it. I hope you guys are listening because I told you about this show. But they he was going to take the cherry one they're having trouble with, and they were going to see what they could do to fix it. And he was there for it.
Yeah.
Got what you need? Anything fermented, oriented, kombucha, cheese, yogurt, beer, wine, mead.
And this is not just for those of you in the Kansas City area. This is for countrywide because
Yeah, they ship.
they ship. They are doing more and more business shipping because, frankly, there are less and less homebrew stores.
Yeah.
I mean, I know our fellow podcast hosts, James and Steve from Basic Brewing Radio, apparently are ordering from them now too
Yeah.
because there's just not a convenient homebrew store
We
near them.
actually, in the last 12 months or so, we've lost two, the other two, within the immediate search area around our city. There were three, and now there's one. So, yeah, by all means, please look them up. Use our code MHP10. Get yourself 10% off and tell them we sent you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Box and Barleycorn. Jeez.
Yeah. So, 12%.
12%. This is an outgrowth, as we talked about before. And one of the things we need to talk about, we need to remember when we talked about osmotic pressure.
Yes.
Osmotic pressure is like the idea that there is more sugar on in the mead than yeast can handle, and it will essentially draw some of the water out of the yeast and make them not functional. That is, we've not reached a point where this is like actual honey, and that it will effectively make it antimicrobial. But the fact that we are adding more sugar to the mead is going to make it harder for the mead to ferment. At 12%, it's not that hard. Any of the wine yeast you can buy at your local homebrew store
Can do 12%.
are going to handle it. Most of the beer yeasts are probably going to do 10 to a little plus. You've got plenty of options at this range, but we are definitely making a stronger ABV mead here.
Therefore, read your packages. Make sure whatever what you've got is has the range you need.
Right,
In this
absolutely.
case, like you said, most every all will work. However, if you're going to go any higher, you need to have that the wiggle room.
And all of these mead products, either at your home or store or on their website, the manufacturer website, are going to have white pages or their little material safety data sheets or material usage data sheets or whatever that are going to tell you know, the temperature range and the alcohol tolerance and whether or not it has a kill factor. I don't think we've ever talked about kill factor yet, but
We can do that a little bit later.
we'll throw kill factor in some episode sometime. It's complicated.
But the point is, you need to make sure your yeast is able to handle the level of sugar you have. It is, and you don't want, okay, if you're going to, I think it's my E1118,
EC1118.
that can go up to 18%, theoretically. I did an 18%. It took forever. It took, I mean, it took several months for it to finish, and I didn't get all the sugar out. It simply couldn't get all of it out.
Right.
I mean, it didn't have any wiggle room. Didn't have it was going to go to its maximum as best it could.
No, the other thing we need to think about here is that the alcohol creation curve, shall we say, for yeast is not a kind of a logarithmic line where we say, okay, we're making 50% more alcohol. So if my 8% took 3 weeks, my 12% must take 4.5. No, it's
No.
probably going to be closer to 2 months or maybe even three,
Maybe three.
because the more alcohol that you're adding into that solution, the harder it is to make the
It's harder
yeast
for
do their
the
thing.
yeast to multiply and start eating all the sugars. It has to get its colony going before it can really get to work. That said, that takes longer.
Right. So you will see the time for your fermentation increase dramatically, even in this difference of, 8 to 12%. But 12% is, I think, it's a wine strength beverage. I think that's more of an appreciable level of alcohol quantity that people think of when they think of wine. The mead has its, what do I want to say, it's late Renaissance from fantasy novels and Lord of the Rings movies and all
Every
these.
Viking story you've ever heard.
Right. We think about this like relatively alcoholic drink and not like a nice, it's barely more alcoholic than a craft beer at 8%. We're thinking like it's wine. We're gonna fill up a horn and drink that, right?
Yeah, just never set it down. But here we go. So a 12%, you're going to start with a little more honey than you think to start with.
Right. I don't use poundage for honey as a general rule because honey that the sugar quantity varies year by year, season by season, varietal by varietal. I will target a gravity. If you remember from the 8%er, our target gravity was 1065 or 1.065.
Yes.
For this guy, at 12%, we're going to target 1.090, a nice round number. That's actually going to be, if you finish at 1.000 final gravity, it's going to be a little under 12. If you're doing this right, if you're following the instructions, you may overshoot and go to like 0.998, for example, in which case you'll be over 12. Once you go under that,
1.0998.
no, 0.998.
Okay. Oh, yeah, under.
Yeah,
Yeah.
once you go under the one, this, like, again, this is one of those things where that each little point counts for a lot fast, because it takes a lot of alcohol to displace water, right?
Technically, 1.000 is no sugar left. I actually had a batch not too terribly long ago that went just under. And I was stunned. I never had that before, but there you go.
I think the lowest I've ever gone was 009, I'm sorry, 0994.
Jiminy Christmas.
Right. That could not have been drier if it was, dehydrated in the
Jesus.
Sahara.
You're not drinking wine, you're drinking sandpaper here. Wow.
Like, clean the kitchen counter, a little for you, a little for me.
And I'll feel great later anyway. Okay, so what you're going for 1.000 or just under.
Well, that's our
Ideal.
ideal. Yeah. We're going to start at 1090 for starting gravity. And I think for this one, we probably want to, unless you are confident in your ability to branch out, a good starter again is 71B because it's a reliable workhorse. We know it can take up to 14% ABV and turn that right away, right
Yeah,
like that.
and it's and this is not going to be a struggle for it either.
Right. You have plenty of other options if you're looking to expand. Some great ones, some from my perspective, K1V116, especially if you're gonna look to do more like fruity stuff. That's a nice one. It's also one of those champagne yeasts, so it can handle a little bit higher ABV if that's a direction you want to grow towards. D47 is another favorite of mine.
I love
It
D47.
requires a little bit colder temperature to not throw off flavors. So, you know, if you're doing this in the middle of winter and you've got some space in your garage or your basement, you can keep it
Ideal.
under 68. Why not? This is
Yeah.
a great time for that.
I mean, I think there was a, what Mead told you about that was one of the most tolerant yeasts you've ever had. It was a yeast, not a mead, but a yeast you had.
When it comes to temperatures, if you're doing this in the middle of the summer, you could have a lot of fun with a Kveik yeast. There's several strains of Kveik. My favorite, I think, for the moment is the Voss from Omega.
That's what talking about, yeah.
But there were also, you know, they've got Hothead and they've got Espy and they've got Lutra. If you want a flavor neutral Kveik that can still, you know, ferment at 90 degrees Fahrenheit,
Jesus.
the trick is these guys are absolute nutrient hogs. I'm going to give you some basic nutrient requirements for this. Understand that if you go Kveik instead of D or instead of 71B, you're going to need four times as much.
Oh, so let's just stick with 71B for now.
Right. For the sake of we're educating our listener populace here and giving starting people something easy to work with, a little bit further into the technique, the education, we're going to go 71B again. Now, last time I told you to put everything up front, your nutrient, your additives, things like that. This time, we're going to hold off a little bit. I would recommend at 12%, this is a good time for GoFirm as well.
Yeah.
This is another, GoFirm is a different kind of nutrient, but it is still a nutrient. And you add this with your yeast when you're like blooming it or proofing it, as they say. In this case, we're going to have like a little 5 gram sachet of yeast. We're going to want probably half that, right? If we're doing a single gallon batch, obviously you can scale this up to, you know, 2 gallons,
Whatever.
5 gallons, 10 gallons, anything you like.
Now, please keep in mind the we're telling you the weights. The volume of these things is vastly different. GoFirm is very light and powdery. You're going to lose a lot more than you thought. You're going to lose just in volume. So measure by weight.
Generally, at this size, there are your GoFirm package will tell you, hey, for every gram of yeast that you're rehydrating, you want to use, I think it's like 1.5 grams of GoFirm in 10 times as much volume of water or something along those lines. Follow the package
Yeah,
directions.
follow it. Works.
Usually that equates to something like a quarter cup of warm water, warm, not hot. You don't want to kill the yeast.
Anything under 90 degrees is good.
And mix up the GoFirm and the yeast together. Let those guys hang out for a little bit.
Will literally smell bread when you know it's good. It's yeast. It's going to smell bready.
Ideally, start this up before you mix any of your water and honey together, and by the time you're done, you'll be ready to roll. All you're really looking for at this phase with rehydration or proofing is just proof that it's alive.
Yeah.
Some bubbles.
It doesn't take much.
So we're going to get our honey and water mixed up to 1090. We're going to add not our nutrient per se, but we are going to add any other adjuncts we want to add here. This is like we talked about refining agents. This is a good time to add bentonite.
Bentonite is a great thing, and I highly recommend that.
We talked about sacrificial or upfront tannins, like our little wine tannins or the Rouge Boost or things like that. This is a great time to add those. That way they get involved right at the start when the yeast are doing their thing. So depending on your mead, and honestly, if you're just doing a traditional mead, you probably don't need
You don't need a whole lot of anything.
right.
The benzonide in strictly for the purpose of keeping it clear.
That just helps it clear later. A little bit of wine tannin up front, maybe like a quarter teaspoon, is probably overkill.
Yeah, so
But
and you honestly wine tannin can be put in a little later
it can.
without much penalty.
The only advantage is that it also gives the byproducts of the fermentation something to bond to get a little bit rounder mouthfeel up the front. That way you're not waiting quite as long for it to age out. But this is a minor thing. None of these are necessary. You could easily go in with just honey water yeast and be fine. The thing is, this first week of fermentation is a little bit more involved now because first, we're not going to put nutrient in until about 24 hours after we see bubbles. This way we have a proof, we have verification that the yeast colony has kind of gone to full size and is working, and we're not accidentally feeding a, what I want to say, a cross-contamination kind of colony instead. But this also lets the yeast eat up some of the stuff in the GoFerm first before they get to the nutrient. I previously said, we'll repeat, I don't like feeding my yeast DAP, the diammonium phosphate. I think it's a little too much fuel, a little too fast. I like to go just straight for Formate K or Formate O. K is my preference. O works just fine. And
The only difference is cost and amount you put in.
I use
That's not the only thing. Formate O is good if you like vegetarian options for whatever reason, or veggie options for whatever reason. I don't know why you know it for mead because it's not. But Formate K is a little cheaper and it's used a little bit less.
So in this case, I like to use a formula to determine how much nutrient I need. And I don't know, should we go into the formula? Do we want to skip the math stuff for
Okay,
later?
go over it lightly. But let's put the formulas online so that way you can plug your own numbers in and you can see the math. And we'll put an example in with it so you see how it's supposed to work out.
And this is a gross oversimplification of Sergio Mattela's TOSNA or TIOSNA
God,
system.
he was 90% mathematician.
But basically, what we're going to do is we're going to convert our starting gravity at 1090 to bricks. And if I remember right, that's about 21.6% bricks.
I'll take your word for it. I don't use bricks.
And then we're going to do some math that basically, like, we're going to times 10 that. So it's going to be 216, right?
Fair enough.
Different yeasts have a different, like, what do I want to say, a
Preference.
different nutrient need
Okay,
level.
yeah.
And so we're going to multiply that 216 by that nutrient need level. In this case, we're using 71B. It doesn't need much, so it's going to be a smaller number. If we were going to, this is a, in this case, 71B is like a 0.7 on that need level.
Sounds
If we
right.
were using Kveik, this number would be 4. So a lot more.
Yeah.
Probably when I said it would take four times as much, probably more than four times as much.
Okay.
But and then at that point, we're going to multiply by the number of gallons we're making,
And I put that amount in.
and then we're going to divide by the nutrient quality.
Okay, I was wrong.
In this case, we're going to take, because we're using Fermi K, we're going to divide by 100, assuming we're going to get it like 100 parts per million or whatever, some yeast assimilable nitrogen in quantity. And that gives us, according to my math here, around about 1.5 grams total Fermi K we need. Or because we're going to take this nice and slow, now that we've got a little bit more fermentation to do, and we're going to encounter that, like we said, that difficulty curve as more and more alcohol gets, brought out. Since we're encountering that difficulty curve, we're going to split this up. We're going to do actually four different feedings. The first feeding we're going to do is, again, 12 to 24 hours after we notice airlock activity. We know that the yeast is doing its thing. It's got a firm colony. It is established, and it has outcompeted any other potential form of competition. The next one is the next day. 24 hours later, we're going to add that second set. Depending on how your yeast are going, you can add the next one the third day. You can add the next one 2 days after that, 4 days, fourth day. The last addition is going to be when we hit the one-third sugar break. What does that mean?
That means that your specific gravity has gone down to approximately a third lower than it was before.
Right. So if we have a starting gravity of 1090, that means once we hit 1060.
1060, you're putting the last one in.
Right. Now, what happens if the yeast just takes off like gangbusters? We get to, it's not even time for our third feed, and we've already hit that one-third sugar break.
I'm still going to put it in. I'll put it in as soon as I can, but I'm still putting it in.
I honestly, if you're early for one feeding, I don't think it's that big of a deal. If you got like the yeast has just torn through everything, you might not need that 4th feeder. You might want to wait another day instead of waiting for the 1/3 sugar break. Just put in the 3rd feeding, see if you need the 4th feeding after another day. This is
I
where
mean,
it gets
just
a
because I
little.
don't want to waste it, I'm going to put it in.
Well, you can over-nutrient a mead and you get some weird metallic taste if you do that, but the quantities we're talking about here at doing a single gallon batch for like 1.5 grams of
Nutrient.
nutrient, we're talking about essentially 0.38. Let's be honest, nobody has that fine of a scale in their kitchen,
Yeah.
even if you've got a jeweler's scale. So we're going to call this 0.4 grams per dose. Nothing.
Yeah, it's. I don't think this scale. I don't think it'll hurt anything.
Right. If you're scaling this up to 10 gallons and we're doing 4 grams per feed, that's still not very much at all, dude. So,
Apparently, this the yeah. But anyway, so now you've done your
right.
three to four feedings.
There's another thing we need to think about during this first week here, and this is one of those things that, like I've said before, I'll say again. If someone had told me when I was first getting started to do this, it would have saved me so much headache. And you're not going to believe it. It's as simple as degassing.
Yeah.
Twice a day is how I like to do it. And I literally, the same little like drill mount stir rod that I use to break up the honey and mix everything up is usually what I use here. But I got started just using the little glass wine thief and like whittling it through the bottle of the,
Now, if you do this with a 1 gallon bottle, you can literally pick up and just rotate it around your hands and
Gentle shaking.
gentle
Yeah.
shaking, and it'll be fine.
So the reason this is
That's what I
important.
do with small batches.
Exactly. Yeah. No. And the reason this is important, though, is the yeast are microscopic organisms. They burp out microscopic amounts of CO2, and that CO2 stays dissolved in the liquid. The trick is when it's in water like this, though, it bonds with the water to make carbonic acid, and it drives your pH down. Your pH gets too low, the yeast can't function very well.
So you need to let it go.
Right. And the weird thing is, you can break that bond simply by agitation and giving the yeast somewhere to go.
But if you're making like my larger batch would be a 10 gallon batch, grab your drill and your stirrer and go to town, and you'll see just mounds of bubbles come up. They're going to break fast.
And here's the trick, especially if you want to use Fermate O instead of Fermate K, for whatever reason, Fermate O has a lot more nucleation points than Fermate K. I highly recommend degassing before you add your nutrient.
Okay, I didn't know. I had no idea about that.
When you add something with a nucleation point, the dissolved bubbles, gases, have somewhere to form together and do their bubbly thing. And the first couple times I tried using Fermate O with that very fine powder, all those nucleation points, I got foam overs and blowouts out the yin yang.
I got my biggest problem was my lemon ginger. When I added my last nutrient shot, I was stirring like a fiend, trying to keep it from going over the bucket lip. Rowan and I were we both had a long spoon. We looked like two demented hermits trying to stop a geyser there. But we won. We won. It went down. It was a good 3 to 4 minute war, but it went down and we won. We did this
At
anyways.
least it was only 3 or 4 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, it could
Jesus.
have been much worse.
Yeah. But no, we want to degas. We want to degas not only when we're adding the nutrient, but also twice a day is generally how I like to do it. I know some people do once. Some people may do as often as they think about it, which is overkill for me, but I got other things going
There was
on.
actually a formula, snap or stem or some an acronym that somebody told me at one point when they do step nutrient thing.
Yes.
But yeah, which is just what we're talking about right now. It's the same thing, but just set a watch. It's so much easier to do
I
that
think you're talking about SNAP, Staggered Nutrient Addition Protocol.
That's it.
Yep. No, these have been floating around the internet in one shape or flavor for years and years and years, and everybody has their own favorite one. I like this one because I like knowing and having a basis for the amount of nutrient I'm going to need determined by the amount of sugar I'm putting into the mead. That makes the most sense to me.
And I'm a simple man. I don't need anything overtly complicated.
Right.
So now you've done your fourth or your last nutrient feeding.
Right.
This is where your patience steps in. Cap it, airlock it, leave it alone.
This is essentially going to be a lot like the 8% in that after this first week and you're done with the nutrient feeds and the degassing, and I honestly recommend you keep degassing the entire week. That buildup of CO2 will lessen over that time. It's going to hit its peak around 2 or 3 days in, but it's still going to keep going. And you're going to clear faster. You're going to get the flavor you want a little bit faster if you get rid of that dissolved CO2, and you're going to have less stalls towards the end, which is the most aggravating thing you can freaking experience when it
Now,
comes to making a mead.
yeah, and mind you, the degassing, although it's as important as it is, it's not the only thing you're doing. You're also assuring there's no honey bubbles. They got for some reason didn't get mixed in the first time. They've happened. I mean, I've had one where I had enough honey bubble in there that my specifically shot up visibly on my hydrometer, and I didn't know what to do with my alcohol content of that anymore. It turned out okay, but and it was very likely I did not stir it sufficiently on the onset. However, if you stir it periodically, it will ensure that the yeast has access to all the sugars it's going to eat.
And it'll break it up. And honestly, yeah, I've had a similar, I want to say the second or third batch I did. I was in that phase of mead making where I wanted to take a gravity reading every day just to determine if it was working right, and I was not trusting the process.
Yeah, I trust probably if I saw bubbles, it was working.
But at one point, like day two or day three, I took a gravity reading and my gravity had gone up 10 points.
And that's where it was. Found the
Exactly.
honey.
Yeah. The honey got mixed in finally, better than it had been. And well, that's weird. But I guess I need to mix better in the future, and this might be a little more alcoholic than I anticipated it being, but that's probably okay.
It was okay. It was okay with my. Actually, I don't know if Jeff recalls. I mean, when I found out my gravity went up several points for me, I was like, Jeff, what'd I do? Jeff! He goes, you probably had a honey bubble. Don't worry about it. And I didn't, and it worked out.
Yeah, just fine. So now that we've got it through that first week, we're in primary. We're in primary hard and fast. And primary is still going to be somewhere between 3 to 5 or 6 weeks. It's generally about a month, sometimes a little longer, depending on so many factors, temperature, type of yeast, how much feeding it, what else you've got in there.
And your number one tool for knowing when it's done is your hydrometer.
Right.
That's what you need. I mean, once it reaches 1.000 or below, it's done. It can't go any farther. The only reason you'd have to do it to stop it any sooner than that is if you want the sugar left behind.
Generally, I don't advocate for people having sugar left behind at this phase. I think you should stabilize and add sugar to back sweetening to get the sugar you're wanting. Again, there are so many good things you could do here as far as like back sweetening with varietal honeys or just fun honey that can give you a nice flavor to it that is different than leaving the residual sugars behind. But
Give
also, this
yourself the
gives you.
best canvas you can to work with.
Right. This also gives you the control to say, okay, this is definitely a 12% mead.
Yeah.
And we didn't overshoot, we didn't undershoot, whatever. But we're in primary. We want to be watching our mead, and we want to be checking on it periodically. You don't have to be completely fermented to end primary, but you want to end primary once you see, not necessarily clearing, but when it is calming down, shall we say. It's not as opaque. You're not seeing as many bubbles. The dropping rate on your hydrometer, the gravity rate dropping, isn't as fast. And usually the best like indicator, if you've got a clear fermenter like a glass bottle, is you're getting a chunk of detritus on the bottom. Once you've got a sizable chunk, then it's time to rack. It's time to move it into secondary. Secondary is a lot slower process, especially like we were talking about before. Now that we're doing a higher ABV ferment, this will take longer. Secondary can take 2 or 3 months sometimes. It can take longer sometimes. But,
If you're very lucky, it may take only two.
right. At 8%, you can basically get away with having little to no secondary activity whatsoever. At 12%, you've got to allot some time for it because secondary does a lot of things. This is where the yeast clean up. Not only do they get rid of the sugar that is a little harder for it to get to once it's at a higher alcohol level, but it will also get to some of the yeast byproducts that are made through the fermentation. And can throw off flavors if they accumulate. So the yeast will, with an absence of sugar, also start, eating those or biotransforming those to make that go away. We want that.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Like we have said this before, even within the last few episodes, the hardest workers in this is the bees and the yeast. But we are the gatekeepers, we're the caretakers. We have to let them do their job, we have to make sure they're doing their job. That's a mead maker. After secondary, you just advance to X amount of time, 2, 3, whatever months in secondary.
Right. If we're just doing a traditional meat, stabilize, back sweeten, bottle. Easy, easy peasy. At 12%, I'm gonna have a harder time carbonating this. I think this prickly pear, this is a standard strength meat, so this is probably in the 12 to 14% range, I think. And they've got it nicely carbonated. That probably takes some effort, though.
I like working with stills simply because I don't work well under pressure. This doesn't make it easy. If you're going to add a flavor at this point, we talked about spices a couple episodes ago. We're going to get a tea bag or a tea
Strainer, coat,
strainer or
thing.
something water or liquid permeable.
Yeah, vinyl bags from your homebrew store.
Not on bags from, box of barley corn, your homebrew store works great. Put whatever amount of flavor you want. I'll be honest, and measure it because it's kind of important. I mean, count the grains, count whatever. With my apple pie, I talked about a while back, I put in 2 4-inch sticks of cinnamon. I put 18 clove, whole clove pieces, and I put in 8 allspice, whole allspice pieces. I ground them up and I put it in the satchel and I tied it up and dropped it in. Now, to make yourself easier on yourself, when you tie up your bag, have a long piece of floss on the end of it, drop it in, leave part of it hanging out of your bucket, put it back in so you can pull it back out when you're ready.
Oh, yes.
You don't have to fish for it. It's right there. I've done it every which way wrong. I've done it with I just dump the spices in with no bag at all. Do not recommend. You'll never get it all out until you strain. I have done it with just putting the bag and I threw it in and I didn't have anything to grab onto later. And I had to hunt for that because and after that I had to let it settle all over again.
Right.
With a piece of floss, unwaxed floss. I'll make that point right now. Use unwaxed floss.
Good reminder.
Just pull it out, you're done. And once you put the seasoning in, wait a day or two. I recommend two, personally. And then taste it. If it's where you want it, stop. Me, I like a nice rich spice flavor. I will generally put mine in for a week or so, but I'll taste it every 2 days. And toward the end, when it's getting close to what I want, every day. And after that point, and then you pull it out, it's time to let it rest.
And this end of secondary phase where we're talking about flavoring, this is another great thing another great phase to talk about that topic we discussed about a month ago. Okay.
Okay, this is where you're going to throw your oak in.
Yeah. My preference generally about half of an ounce worth of the oak cubes of your flavor of choice. Medium French is a great place to start. I think it gives you kind of everything you want and not much of anything you don't. But if you want more of the vanilla, a little bit more of that bourbony flavor, go American. If you want more baking spices, go Hungarian.
The oak you get will tell you what you're going to get off it. The thing you do not want to do. You leave any of these in over 2 weeks.
2 to 4 weeks is about the extent of the good flavors you get out of the oak.
After that, you're going to get some off flavor you're probably not going to like
Right. It's more woody in a bad way, vegetal
in a
again.
green way.
Yeah.
And so, if you get to the end of, like, say, 2 to 3 weeks, and you're sitting here, I just want more flavor. Take it out, put new more flavor in, put new spices, oak, whatever in.
You could always refresh and add more. And trying to get more out of the same amount of oak is like trying to wring out a wrung out sponge.
Yeah, use your flavors like flavors. If it's out of that flavor, you can't use it anymore. Move on.
And seriously, I would advocate for oaking, even if you don't intend oak to be a strong flavor. Once you've got other flavors in place, the addition of those oak tannins and the little nice notes that those bring do such a good job of kind of marrying things together, rounding out the harsh edges. You can use oak just to, if it's a little too acidy, it'll calm that down. Or if it's got a little too much of that alcohol burn, calms that down too. you don't even have to keep it in there for more than, if you go under a week, you probably won't be able to detect much of any oak flavor at all. So this is a very useful tool to me.
Yes. And it's one I'm learning. So I'm trying to now if you are really if you're absolutely scared of having the flavors of the American or the Hungarian oak in it, white oak's an option. It's very mild. It can help. It won't help as much as the others, but it will help round out things.
Yeah, there are a number of different oak products out there. The basic, American or French or Hungarian, whatever, are a great starting point for this. And really, I still use those 90% of the time. They're really all the more I need.
And this is when you need, as a mead maker, you need to start paying attention. Taste it frequently. You're not gonna, if you, your thief is gonna get you, what, a quarter ounce, maybe, in your cup, and move on. You're
Well,
just trying to figure it out.
you say taste it frequently. Taste it frequently is a relative term.
Okay,
Let's,
fair enough.
taste it a couple times a week. Maybe more if you've got something like if you're doing a capsamel and you got hot pepper in there, you might want to taste it more than once a week.
Well, it tastes more
You
once a day.
don't want to overdo that. I mean, the one time I made the ghost pepper mead, I told you my contact time was half of a ghost pepper for about 2 or 3 hours. That
Yes.
was all the Rahat I wanted out of it. I got it and I went, okay, that's gone.
So yeah, but pay attention to your, and as you're tasting, just, I mean, with the like with the apple pie, I'm doing it every couple of days. Not a big deal. With when I remake my sarsaparilla, it'll be every couple of days. With my Earl Grey Moonlight, I will be every 3 to 4 days, to be honest, because I'm not really expecting it to really infuse that flavor really fast. But here we go, But the closer you get to your flavor, the more frequently you should check it. And when you get close enough, stop. Pull it out, let it sit for a day or two, let it, meld all together and then taste again. If it's not good, start it up.
Yeah, no, generally adding a little bit more fresh flavorant, like your baking spices or your oak or your what have you, are going to give you better results than throwing old stuff back in or letting it sit a little bit longer if you've determined it's not quite where I want it yet. So I always like to have that option available to me. Another great thing we can talk about here is tincturing, which is it's a different way to get the flavors we want, where basically we soak that flavoring, whatever, is it an herb, is it a spice, in some alcohol and get like a basically, a concentrated flavor out of it.
Effectively, what do you call those? Like essential oil of flavors. I don't know what you call
Kind of,
it.
yeah.
But and if you're using spices like I do, like I'm doing with my pumpkin pie, I use the whole piece of spice and I grind it and put it in a satchel. I want the oils because they're going to do more good for me. But there you go. Once you get that done, you're going to settle it. I personally rack it out one more time to get whatever sediment I can out of it. And then if I'm happy there, I am ready to sweeten in the bottle.
Yep, I will stabilize. Usually I will find it at that point and then
Oh, we didn't mention, killing off the yeast at any given point. At the end of
stabilize.
this, stabilize, you're going to stabilize it and kill off your yeast. Then I'm going to rack it one more time. I'm going to let it sit for a day, rack it one more time, sweeten it, and I'm done.
Yeah, no. There, the fact is that this sounds like a basic recipe. This is just a 12% mead recipe. The idea is that I'm giving you a basic building block here to do basically whatever you want with. I mean, the if you want to make a fruit mead, once you figured out this, the 1090 ABV equals 12%. I'm sorry, 1090 starting gravity equals 12% ABV.
Yes.
Not all of that starting gravity, for example, has to come from honey. We could dump, some 2 or 3 pounds of blueberries in there, get them all mashed up so we get the juice th going through it, add honey to get to our 1090. We've still got a 12% ABV, but with blueberries.
But with blueberries, because the fruits are going to have sugars. You can do it with the Temish, the pineapple. Whatever you got, what you're targeting is your specific gravity. Whether it's bricks or a specific gravity, I like specific gravity. I can read it easier. I don't want to mess with bricks because that just was more on my plate. But I'm a simple guy. I've said this before. But go wild. I mean, but again, just the basic honey mead recipe he gives you for 12% at the 1090 is all you need. After that is you're playing with flavor.
Once you've got the basics of how the 8% works and how the 12% works, basically any recipe that I give you from here on out is going to make perfect sense to you.
And when we give you a recipe for a blueberry mead or an apple mead or whatever mead we give you, I don't want that fruit. I want this fruit over here. Do it. Do it. That's how you do this. I was told by mead masters, the recipe stays the same no matter what fruit I put in it.
Believe it.
So there you go. And so I'm wishing you all the best in making your first 12% mead if this is your first time. Is there anything else you want to cover on this one?
No, I think that pretty much gets us to where we can go hog wild with this. We can experiment with different yeasts. We can experiment with different flavors of like fruit and spice. And like we were talking about, we could oak it, we could not, we can could maybe carbonate it. We're a little too alcoholic for carbonation, but now that you got these two in your back pocket, you can innovate from this pretty easily. Just make small changes as you dare and report the results. I think that's a great way to expand what we all know, expand what we all do.
I think of a future piece of an episode. I think I'll talk about how to carbonate with you guys. I mean, the amounts of to help carbonate, within safe ranges, because that's a whole new ball of wax I'm not particularly fond of or want to get into, but you might, and I want you to have the information.
Yeah, no, and to be honest, the safer and more expensive way to do that is always with a keg.
Yes.
Kegs are designed to hold pressure like that, whereas the bottle carbonation, we are, even if you're doing, glass that's rated for that, you could accidentally drop in an extra ounce of sugar and get, you turn your 24 pack of 12-ounce mead bottles into a 24 pack of mead grenades.
Yes, and as fun as that might sound, with all the explosions and everything, it's a sticky mess to clean up, and we don't want
And pulling shards of glass out of your skin is no fun either.
that. Details, mere details. Anyway, thanks for joining us today, Jeff. Thank you for having me over again. We have to do this again. Let's say next week. What do you think?
I don't have anything else planned, so
Okay, excellent. So, talk to you later, and take care, everybody out there. Have a great day. Good night.